The Every Diabetic Counts program is a program. I work for the Delmarva Foundation, which is a QIO, Quality Improvement Organization, which is a contracting organization for CMS to assure that Medicare beneficiaries get high-quality care. There, initially, those organizations were founded in the Social Security Act. So if your elder relative goes in the hospital and doesn't like what happens, they call 1-800-MEDICARE. The contractors like Delmarva answer the phone. That's the core business of those organizations. And in about the 80s, they started to add things like quality improvement. So if anybody here works for a hospital and you have to send in surgical care improvement project data, or you have to see who's smoking in your hospital, those kind of things, that data gets funneled through the QIO, and we work with the hospitals and organizations in terms of improving those indicators. In the last contract, the last 3 years, Medicare decided they wanted to do something with improving disparities. And this was actually under a project within CMS called Improving Disparities. And actually, Dr. Alan Herman from the University of South Africa, who is running the project in Mississippi, and I are actually presenting on the program tonight at 6, so if you want to come see that across the way. Early in the morning and late at night, I'm not sure how I got those two time slots. But. At any rate, so this project was designed under Medicare's assumption that if we work with the physicians in the community, we will improve disparities for populations that have these issues with diabetes. They made assumptions, so some of the requirements were the physicians that we partnered with. In D.C. and Baltimore, we partnered with approximately 300, 350 physicians, and they had to have at least 25% of their population had to have had to be a disparity. Okay. They also did this project in New York. I don't know if you guys work with them or not at all. But so, and one of the things we found when we did this project was that the physicians, unlike Medicare's assumptions, what the data we showed was the physicians weren't really the issue. The patients that were going to the doctors were getting the testing done that needed, and they were cared for well. We trained, we provided diabetes education to over 2,000 people in D.C. and Baltimore, and nationwide this was done 6 places. The project trained about 13,000 people. So it was a really large public health project for people with diabetes. And everybody in this room knows this, but basically over the last 10 years, this needle has not moved. About 50% of the population with diabetes that needs diabetic retinal screening, they are not getting it. What we discovered also, we also surveyed our patients, so we did about 2,000 surveys on the people that we trained. We went out into senior centers and trained people in diabetes education. I had previously worked for a hospital and ran a diabetes education center, and about 10 years ago I started working with a company called ITEL, and they do on-site digital retinal imaging. And for a screening tool to screen out patients who are at high risk and need to go see an ophthalmologist fairly quickly, their business model wasn't that strong at the time. And I actually ran the practice, had a physician working for me. We had an ITEL in the office, and we couldn't get the doctor to get those people screened in their practice no matter what. And that was one of the reasons the business model failed, was that it did not fit into the primary care model of what we have to do every day. And that, I believe, is one of the reasons that there's a challenge in primary care, is because they're having to do very quickly what that patient came in for that day. They don't have time to think about all the other things, and to assign a nurse to take that person, get their eyes dilated, it just didn't work. So ITEL came up with a new model, and I thought it would be good for this project. Okay, the baseline, and this comes from Medicare claims data for calendar year 2007 for eye exams in Maryland and the District of Columbia, was 56%. That's for Medicare beneficiaries with diabetes, and it's not racially or ethnically screened. That's just the total number. Okay, so what we did, because I was working for a government contractor, and I still am, I had to find out were there any other organizations out there doing it. There were only 3 vendors that were still doing this, one of which had turned completely into a research institute and wouldn't open this up, and the other was solely relying on government contracts. So we got approval from CMS to work with this vendor, who is ITEL, to work to improve retinal assessment for beneficiaries with diabetes. We did not. There was no money exchanged, and I don't have any disclosures to put forth. We just hooked up the relationship between the primary care practices we were working with and ITEL. It was up to ITEL to make that happen afterwards. Okay, so this is the system. The system takes a digital photograph of the retina, which is uploaded to a central reading center, which happens to be Wilmer, and the report is faxed to the referring physician. It has been demonstrated in multiple studies to be equivalent to a clinical exam. That's not saying you shouldn't get one if the screening tool says you should. And if the video works, which doesn't look like it's going to, does it? Okay, well, if the video was working, it would show you the thing, and some cool guy would give you a speech about how awesome the ITEL device is and show you how the exam is done. Essentially, what's nice about it is it's very simple. So you can train technicians to do it. You basically look into a scope, and while you're looking into that scope, the person's eye comes up as an image, an actual picture of the eye in live, and you line up where the thing is supposed to take a picture, and the technician just pushes a button, and it takes multiple images of the eye. They get uploaded to the reading center, and a report gets sent back to the physician's office. So these are the papers that that came out that validated what they were seeing on the screens from a screening perspective in terms of what the retina looked like was matching what a live eye exam through an ophthalmologist did. Okay. From April 2010 to June 2011, we screened 650 patients, which in and of itself is a really good accomplishment because from a numbers perspective, we had 2,000 people in our program. And this program was originally designed, remember, the assumption was that we needed to get in and take care of those physicians that weren't taking care of those patients. Well, they were taking care of their patients, but they weren't referring people to these classes that we were teaching. So the project was designed with, if we go out and we meet with the physicians, they'll refer patients to us, we'll teach the patients classes, the patients will come back to the doctor and get all the tests they need. That's not how it worked in reality. How it worked in reality was we said we need to just go out into the community and screen people. So we went right out into the senior centers. We went into pharmacies. We went everywhere. That's the only way we would have educated as many people as we did, which was over 2,000 people. For the diabetic process, what happens is ITEL now has a system where they send in a technician. So for the doctors that agree to it, they refer a list of patients to the vendor that have diabetes and need an eye exam for screening. Now, what we found out when we talked to the patients, which I'd like to discuss with you in detail afterwards, is the main reason they said that they didn't get their eye exams done, there were two main reasons. And this was pretty anecdotal, but we were working in the poor, disadvantaged sections of the District of Columbia, Prince George's County, and Baltimore. We had police escorts in some cases, so this was a rough area. Many, many of the people we spoke with who were elderly African-American women said, I'm afraid to leave my house. So that's why they don't go to the doctors, and that's why they don't go to get their eye exams done. And the copays associated with an ophthalmology exam were pretty high. And although I agree that the exam is painless, it's not fun shining a bright light in your eye. And, you know, if you're not used to that, it can be kind of a shock. Okay. This is what I want. Well, the reason I came here to present, because I didn't know if this information was out there yet, but in terms of what we're seeing from the screening tool, 4% of the people, of the 650 people we screened, and this was consistent, so we watched this over time. Every month I got in the data. Every month we looked at how many people we acquired. 4 to 5% of that population walking around with diabetes, just like you said, unaware of their vision, required urgent referral to a specialist, meaning they were at risk for hemorrhage or blindness immediately. 14% of them required referral to a specialist, and 82% of them just needed annual follow-up. So it was a pretty significant problem if you extrapolate those numbers up to the entire volume of patients with diabetes walking around today. These are not all African-American or underserved populations. This is whoever the doctor referred. We didn't segment the population. Okay? Then we went back in because we wanted to see how much this had improved things. One, the way Medicare judged our company was, did you hit the target of increasing the total number of eye exams percent by from 50% to whatever? And I wanted to, based on their previous year. So what we did, we actually did go back in and pull the charts on all the patients that we screened. And what we found out was in the previous year, these are people that who got a screening. Only 33% had a retinal exam the last year. Only 7% had a retinal exam within the last 2 years. And only 2% had an eye exam within the last 3 years. So not a large percent of this population. And these are people who are going to the doctor regularly. The other thing you'll notice, because we work directly with a lot of these physicians, if you ask these physicians, are they referring their patients for diabetes eye exams, they will all say yes. And what we noticed is most of them are. We didn't study that in detail, but they do get the referrals. The patients just don't follow up on them. And unfortunately, the government contracting world, we can't pay the patients to go get their eye exams or take a survey or give them any kind of financial incentive, although it would help them a lot if they had cab fare and co-pays and things like that. So what we found out is the reason that this we think this was successful, because overall we increased the number of underserved Medicare beneficiaries getting eye exams by an absolute number of 4%, which is pretty high when you figure that number has just been sitting there at 50%, 55% for the last 10, 20 years. And the way we made that happen was we have people who spend a lot of time in the offices building strong relationships with the physicians and seeing value in what they do, trying to make things easier for the physicians. But you have to be able to get the technology to the patient. So in some cases, I know that there are mobile vans that go around and do screenings for patients, and that works. This is kind of a similar model. Actually, 10 years ago, there was a similar company doing this with vans, where they were going around and taking retinal imaging like that. That company doesn't exist anymore either. But this issue is about access. I think part of it may be about education about it. We also found out on the baseline, nobody knew what an eye exam was. They also didn't know what an A1C was. We taught them, they got better. We didn't do any kind of relationship between did they get eye exams after that. We didn't have time to do that. But it really was about what we heard loud and clear from the patients was, we can't get to an ophthalmologist. We're not going to go to an ophthalmologist unless we really need to. We also did not do follow-up, although we're planning on doing that. Out of those urgent requirements, did any of them actually get to an ophthalmologist? So that's something we're looking into doing now. So this issue, I believe, is all about access to care, and bringing the technology to the patients in the physician's office is a good way to do it. That's all I have. Thank you.
So what I'd like to do is, if you want, I can invite the speakers to come up to the front and we can have a Q&A session, or you can just make it casual and stay in the audience. So, All right. Bring them up front. All right, please, speakers, come join us up front at one of these four lovely chairs. What's behind chair number one? Thank you. So, any questions?
I use the National Diabetes Education Program, but I wasn't aware of that, so send me the link and we'll push out whatever
you can. Find yourself, nei.gov, NEHEP, National Eye Health Education Program, English, Spanish. The Spanish format is also designed for lay educators, health promotores, and it also is done in a telenovela, comic book style as well. There's videos, there's PowerPoints, there's print material, there's fantastic validated, evidence-based, beautiful materials available that you do not have to spend your resources creating.
I think one of the challenges is, just to address that, is that it's still got to get out to the patients.
Yes.
And one of the people who I think has done a really good job in this is Dr. Huerta at Washington Hospital Center's Cancer Prevention Program. He's been doing it for years. He has a radio. He records healthcare messages about cancer prevention that he's gotten the buy-in from the local Latino community. And when he says it's October, get a mammogram, the mammogram rates shoot through the roof. And that seems to me to be a really good way of getting access to people, but I'm not sure a lot of people are latching on to that, because the materials you're describing are good, but I don't know how to get them in the hands of all of them. I can put them in the doctor's office, but
people can find an ophthalmologist to get treatment should they need it. So that's sort of an added, I guess, component to our toolkit. It's very localized. But it's important because we understand we're out to, you know, engage social service providers in the community to sort of be the messengers of this. They're already very busy with many things, but the advantage of going with them is that they have more constant contact with people in the community. I mean, people probably access social services more than they go to their healthcare provider. So we're fortunate from that point. But you're right, there are materials already developed. I would say ours are much more simplified in what we're doing.
So I think we do have some information materials in the patient's rooms, which we share with them, but I doubt if you give them the handout, I mean, I doubt who is going to read it and who is just going to put it in the trash can. Mm-hmm. So I think the word of mouth really makes a big difference. It's not, you can't really rely 100% on the, I mean, everybody has access to internet. So you can just read about it.
Not everybody.
I mean, but still, many people do. But I think word of mouth also makes a big difference in addition to the handouts.
Yeah, I think it has to be multi-factorial, and you can't get enough of it.
Just a quick thing for all three of you, again, not Bruce.
You want to sit back down?
You know, all three of you are what you're talking about. There is another way. Tom, your approach to getting the treatment or the technology to the person is important. One of the things in D.C. and also in East Harlem is the use of community health centers. And the biggest problem is that optometry is not embedded in primary care. We need a health home in these areas, and the health home needs to have optometry. I hear you all three mentioning ophthalmology quite a lot, but actually these patients should be directed to optometry as well as ophthalmology. And in most cases in these areas, optometry, because they're more accessible. So, you know, I think, for instance, and I don't know what the findings were with the Wilmer, but, you know, out of curiosity, I wonder, did you actually track these patients into care? And if you did they go to optometry or ophthalmology? Did they establish a health home of sorts that where this is sustainable? So those are all questions to ask. Just out of curiosity, in East Harlem, there's a new community health center being built called the Birkin Neighborhood Health Center. They're focusing on asthma right now. They should be Birkin.
Birkin.
They could easily accommodate on-site eye care. You've got SUNY College of Optometry with students.
They're on our resource list.
Yeah, that could go up there. So I'm saying bring the care to the patients, mm-hmm. bring the optometrists
to the patients. That's what Digital Family Medicine is trying to bring the digital retinal imaging into their own practice. So right there.
That's the point. You don't need that. What they need is comprehensive care and a team-delivered approach to care. And you mentioned eye exam, but the digital camera is not providing an eye exam. It's providing a digital retinal screening for retinopathy. So it's just my point. In D.C., you have Unity Healthcare. We've already had discussions with them. They want to put in eyesight. They want optometry on site. The problem is getting HRSA funding to do it. So, you know, why don't we work toward developing sustainable solutions? So I guess my only point here is that what you're doing is great. It's one piece of the puzzle, but, you know, try to, you know, maybe think outside of that and think about establishing a sustainable solution in these communities.
Would that be cost effective?
I completely agree with you, and actually, we actually tried to establish a sustainable solution. We ran into multiple barriers. One is, over the 3 years of this project, it took me 2.5 years to get access to Unity. So in terms of getting somebody to get less in,
we've had discussions with Unity. Unity wants to do it.
I'm hearing it. I'm just saying from our perspective, and they said the same thing to us. But I don't want to talk specifically about, but from an FQHC perspective, it was challenging to get in there and provide. We were offering free educational services for the diabetes patients. Then we also we tried to get.
That's because they don't want retinal imaging there. They want on-site services, comprehensive care for their patients. That you're right. They do not want a retinal camera.
But they didn't really want anything. Is what
no,
I'm saying. They didn't want. We can do. I'd love to follow up.
We tried it with
diabetes education, and we thought about because one of the issues we used the deep curriculum from Dr. Castillo in University of Chicago in terms of diabetes education, and they were running into a problem with the licensing of that curriculum, even though it's a generic. You know, it's the same information, but then getting that out to all the FQHC seemed like a great idea. But we just kept running into challenge after challenge.
Let's talk.
I'd love to follow up with you.
Yeah, thank you.
That'd be okay. I think Renee, and then are you covered?
We're good.
Okay.
Just want to talk about the Philadelphia project. I think one of the problems you are having in Philadelphia is the Eastern Health Plan and the IDC, actually the parent company is the same. There are just two different plans there. The reason you brought up was correct because of the Medicaid population completely. And the other issue that is there is up till 2 years ago, the Eastern Mercy Plan also Medicaid paid for the glasses for the patients who received an eye examination, and then they stopped it 2 years ago. So that's why the patients generally associate eye exam with the glasses, and since they were not covered, so probably that may be another reason that they may not be going. The second thing will be, I don't know if you did a differentiation between the IVC program and the Keystone Mercy program. How many of the patients under Keystone Mercy received a letter from the insurance company itself as a reminder, like the Aetna and the IVC program may have done?
We did not go into those details. I mean, I think the separate study really needs to be done to identify the insurance barriers. And I totally agree with you, getting a reminder letter from the insurance company is very reassuring. It's like, wow, the insurance company is sending me the letter, so it means it's covered, I don't have to pay, it's just a copay. And if you don't get a letter, you are trying to associate that with the eyeglasses. I think that's a very good point. And Keystone Mercy should get back to that. They should not stop doing that. I mean, it's really impacted their rates of getting the dilated eye exam. It's like only 60% versus 95%. So it's a big difference. So something needs to be addressed with the Keystone Mercy.
For East Harlem, I will say that was an issue for us because Medicare doesn't cover glasses. Medicaid does, but the issue was that they only cover, I think it's like up to $50, and so the, you know, as part of this particular project, we covered the extra money. That was the only reason half of these people actually went forward and then got the glasses. They actually had said to us in a focus group, where that's why we don't get things, this go for an eye exam is because we can't afford the things the doctor prescribes, or eye drops, or any of those things.
Okay. In the back, yes.
I'm this sorry. Is actually for Dr. Moore, just to change tracks.
Yeah.
The American Academy of Optometry meeting general, briefly. I can't argue with your results that the students or the young people were able to self-refract well, but I think it's important to note that in the developing world, there's significant opposition to this mode of care for many public health reasons, not the least of which is that it separates refraction from general eye care. So I know we spoke with that at Academy briefly, but I just wanted to make that note, and you can feel free to comment on it.
That's very true. But I guess the point that I would make is that waiting until a fully developed eye care system is available for the broad spectrum of people in rural Africa is going to take a few years. And we view this as only potentially an interim solution to a particular aspect of the problem. It in no way supplants or should supplant the primary goal of development of a full quality system. But it's not going to happen in my lifetime or anybody else in this room's lifetime. So, you know, it comes down to the same issue that do we have a responsibility ultimately only to develop a long-term solution, or do we also have a responsibility to, in addition to that, develop a short-term solution to the problem? I would argue that ultimately we need to do both, not just one or the other. So I fully agree, yeah, a full-blown system makes sense, but it's not going to happen in a short period of time. It's an interim solution.
I think if the unifying theme for all of our presenters today really is about access and about barriers to care. And I can't lose the
you know, they are encouraged to go to either ophthalmologist or optometrist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just piggyback on that? Because I wanted to share something earlier. First, I can really identify with the outreach with the diabetic retinopathy, and I work in communities, and I've worked in very poor rural communities and now an urban community. And in the rural setting, I could identify with your numbers more than I think you're 68%, Michelle, or something, of those that actually received diamond diagnosis. Is that true? Oh,
yeah,
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Yeah.
I apologize. So, yes, but I can relate. Because we had anywhere from 3 to 6% initially, and then 30%, and that was huge. In the poorest rural community in Michigan, which is Lake County, the median income is like $15,000 per family, and over 30% of children in poverty. So the poorest of the poor in that segment. And the one thing I wanted to emphasize, I wanted to ask one on the severity factors of the diabetic retinopathy. I'm assuming that was through that telemed system and ophthalmologists were using the international classification system of severity. I'm assuming that. And what I have found in our communities, and again, it's different in every locale, I understand that. And I was working through a community health center, so there was access there to optometry. It's been nearly impossible for us to get a significant group, at least of players, of ophthalmologists that are willing to deal with our patients that are poorest of the poor. And so what we have is we have Medicaid for children up to age 18. We do not have Medicaid for, did I say Medicare? About Medicaid? We do not have Medicaid coverage for vision care services. Of course, we do for medical for adults. And so what we're finding is that we have lots of undocumented Hispanic Latino patients. We have lots of migrant workers. That not only need bilingual, culturally competent care, but they also need places that are willing to work on a sliding scale. And unless we have ophthalmology within community health centers, it just doesn't happen. And so I wanted to emphasize that kudos for the work that you're doing and for the outreach, because we do need that, and it's a significant piece of the puzzle. But just in, I'm usually not the one waving at the optometry flag, my colleagues will tell you that. But in this particular case, I would say, especially in the rural communities, it's not ophthalmology that's evaluating those patients on a regular basis, if at all. It's optometry that's around. But even in, and I'll just say this, even in the optometric community, it's hard to find optometrists in those communities that will take the Medicaid and the uninsured. And so I do think, going back to Michael's comment, that the community health center is a great place.
You know, honestly, I don't have a dog in the fight as to who actually provides the eye care afterwards.
Well, I
was just trying to get people to it.
No, exactly, and I think it's terrific. And it is a problem with optometry and ophthalmology. It doesn't matter, but it needs to be a cohesive system, and we're not there. We're a long ways away.
Is the ADA working with?
I'm sorry?
Maybe the ADA should be like a primary mediator or something.
Pull
the two groups together.
The ADA, a long time ago, said there's no difference between ophthalmology and optometry in terms of providing that service. That's been around since probably about 8-10 years maybe now. So, you know, that's a good point, though. And that should have been a catalyst to correct this, but it hasn't completely corrected it.
Zinchi had a question, and we've got a couple of minutes left, so I wanted to offer you the opportunity to ask it, and then we can go from there.
It's both rules again. We mentioned access is a big issue, but a lot of people don't have insurance, and they couldn't afford our glasses. But Massachusetts is different. It's universal. I understand for kids with Medicaid, it's covered by Medicaid, but about those with private insurance, does that mean the Massachusetts law, whatever, require private insurance to cover vision insurance?
I'm no expert on that aspect of it for adults, but what I can tell you is that there is widespread access. The issue in Massachusetts is not insurance coverage. The issue goes beyond insurance coverage. So everyone in the state, adults and children, virtually all adults, and almost entirely all children, have insurance coverage. That's not the problem. Acceptance of insurance by providers is somewhat of a problem, and it's a problem in areas that tend to be the more rural areas. I think that's more of an issue out there. We do actually have rural areas in Massachusetts, hard to believe. But there are providers who simply don't want to really accept it. We also have a problem with the eyeglasses. All the eyeglasses under the MassHealth Medicaid program are actually manufactured in a very interesting way in a centralized facility owned by the state called Massachusetts Correctional Institute.
Yeah.
All the glasses are actually made by prisoners in one of the state correctional institutions. They actually do a very good job. It takes time to get them. Sometimes delays can be 2 or 3 months. That turns out to be a real problem. And I think access for adults is one pair every 2 years. Is that right, Stace?
Yes. Adults is one pair.
One pair every 2 years. Children, it's really, really pretty open.
It's usually one pair a year that you can get them if you break them with
a So we do have access. Now, for diabetics, I think there's pretty good access in general. I don't think we really have the same problems that might exist in East Harlem, for example, or in the Washington area. On the other hand, it's the same thing I talked about yesterday, which is we can have an absence of barriers in terms of insurance, but it doesn't mean that everybody actually avails themselves of the care. So we have that as the same problem that everybody else has. And we struggle with that all the time. We have a mobile pediatric service that goes out into communities in Boston that are a direct line of sight with the medical schools that provide a surfeit of access to care. And yet people don't avail themselves. For adults, it's more difficult. And for the homeless populations, it can be even more difficult, as obviously it is everywhere else. So that's true as well for immigrant populations, where language and culture create additional barriers. So insurance is not a problem, but all the other things are still a problem.
I think it goes back to what you said too, whether you're in Africa or in East Harlem, there's other priorities that these communities have. You know, and vision just doesn't make it to the top. Or going to get an eye, it doesn't make it to the top.
Are there any other burning questions? It's 10. I don't know if you have to run off, but I'm sure that if you want to talk afterwards, there'd be people who would love to do that. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you to our speakers.